Okay, let me just begin by discussing reparameterization invariance, because I think Joachim asked last time, what really is this reparameterization invariance? So I want to emphasize to you exactly what it means. So reparameterization invariance is, in fact, nothing but general coordinate invariance on the world line of the particle. Okay, so the physical picture, the reality, if you like, the picture of reality, is that we have some curved space-time M, okay, which is an object which should not depend on coordinates. And we have the world line of some particle, W, which is embedded in that space-time, and again, should not depend on coordinates. I mean, it's a physical thing, right? The particle actually travels through space-time on this line. None of that mentions coordinates, okay? But the same story. In order to actually describe this setup, I have to introduce some coordinates on M. Okay, so there will be some coordinates here. Let's call it x mu. That will be a patch of coordinates. And similarly, I've got to introduce some lambda on the world line. Okay, so I can kind of indicate that by marking this world line. Okay, this is lambda. And so each value of lambda labels some particular point on the world line. And if lambda is going to be a good coordinate on the world line, it better be monotonic. In other words, it better keep increasing along the world line. Okay, so reparameterization invariance just means that it doesn't really matter what lambda I introduce for this description, nor, you know, I should get the same answer. And so you see in this picture there are actually two general coordinate invariances. One is the coordinates on the manifold, the x mu, you're free to choose those. And the other is the lambda, you're free to choose lambda, as long as it's a good coordinate. So when we write down the action, let me write it in the square root form, just kind of for simplicity. Integral d lambda square root minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. Then you can see that because it involves g mu nu dx mu dx nu, if I change coordinates on the manifold to x prime, that's an invariant quantity. Okay, so if we change x mu to x prime mu of x, then s prime, right, this will be it. So I didn't do anything to the lambda. Okay, I just changed the x. Then s prime in it is minus m integral d lambda minus g prime of x prime mu nu, right? When you prime things, you've got to, this is g of x, dx prime mu d lambda, dx prime mu d lambda. Okay? But by the definition of g prime, right, g mu nu prime of x prime is, of course, equal to dx dx prime dx dx prime g mu nu of x, or g alpha beta mu nu. Okay, so if I plug that into there and then use the fact that dx alpha dx prime mu dx prime mu d lambda is equal to dx alpha d lambda, okay, then I see that s prime equals s. Okay, so the action is invariant under general coordinate transformations. And that's kind of obvious because I've just constructed it from a scalar quantity in as far as the coordinates, the space-time coordinates are concerned. So now that we can consider a second invariance of the action, which is lambda goes to lambda prime of lambda. Okay, and it's important that this new lambda prime, if I think of its graph, lambda prime as a function of lambda, it should be monotonic. because I want the d lambda prime d lambda never to vanish. Okay, so I can change coordinates from lambda prime to lambda and lambda to lambda prime freely. They're one to one. So I want this to be one to one. That implies d lambda prime d lambda is never zero. And that's a completely independent transformation on the action, right? So this time, I think of the x mu's as just God-given coordinates, OK? I think of the x mu's as just absolutely given on the manifold. But all I'm going to do is change the coordinates on the world line, lambda, OK? So what this means is that I transform lambda to lambda prime, and of course, x prime of lambda prime, that's the new, that's the world line. Okay, you've got to define now this prime, you see this prime, maybe I should call it lambda twiddle to differentiate. So a world line coordinate transformation, let's call it twiddle, because this is really x twiddle of lambda twiddle. Okay, so I change coordinates on the world line from lambda to lambda twiddle of lambda. And then I need to know, how does x transform when I change from, just like I needed to know how the metric transforms. And the transformation rule is that x is a scalar. So x twiddle mu of x of lambda twiddle is x mu of lambda. Okay? So i.e., x mu transforms as a scalar under under reparameterizations of W, of the world line. OK, so that's just saying something obvious. It's saying that a given value of lambda corresponds to a particular point on this line. Okay, and when I say lambda twiddle is a function of lambda, I'm associating some value of lambda twiddle with the same point, right? But the coordinates of that point should be the same as they were, because that's just x mu. This is some, as I said, some God-given coordinate system as far as this transformation is concerned. And so the actual values of the coordinates should be the same as they were. So let me do something kind of explicit. Let's imagine I've got some curve, e.g., imagine I've got some curve in two dimensions, right, which is cosine lambda sine of lambda. Right, that'll be my curve. What is that curve? In two dimensions, what's that curve? Just a circle, right? That's a circle. It's a directed circle, so. Okay, so that's the circle in x and y. And then I say, what is x twiddle and y twiddle? Well, let's say lambda twiddle is equal to lambda squared. OK? What's wrong with that transformation? What's wrong with setting lambda equal to lambda twiddle equal to lambda squared? Pardon? No negative values, but where does it go wrong? It violated one of my assumptions somewhere. D lambda prime d lambda 0, right? Obviously, so lambda twiddle equals lambda squared looks like that. It's not 1 to 1 at this point. Right? It breaks down because the gradient is not zero. Anyway, let's imagine we do this in some coordinate patch away from zero. Then it's still OK. The slope is positive if I just work in some coordinate patch. And then what I'll see is that x twiddle, y twiddle in the new coordinates are equal to x. OK, so this is equal to cosine. You see, x twiddle of lambda twiddle is equal to x of lambda. That's how a scalar transforms. So x twiddle y twiddle is equal to this thing, sine lambda. And now I solve this for lambda as a function of lambda twiddle. And so this is equal to cosine of root lambda twiddle sine root lambda twiddle. Okay? I'm assuming I'm in this patch where lambda twiddle is bigger than lambda twiddle is bigger than some constant. Let me call it A. Okay, so that's the form of the circle in the new coordinates. Still the same circle, nothing's changed, I've just changed my coordinates on the circle. Okay, and so then the statement is that when I write down a theory that is invariant under reparameterizations, okay, then if this was a solution in the theory for x, then this must be a solution also. Okay. In other words, the circle, however it is parameterized, must be a solution of the theory. Okay, and we can see that's true because the equations of motion, the geodesic equation following from here, following from S, involved things like this, d by d lambda, 1 over square root of minus, well, let me write it a bit bigger, involved basically d by d tau, right? So it involved 1 over root minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda, d by d lambda of x mu. Okay, so remember when I did this derivation, I called all this stuff here d tau. But the fact that the differential equation involves an operator like that means that if x mu of lambda is a solution, then, so if x mu of lambda is a solution, then x mu twiddle of lambda twiddle, okay, what is x mu twiddle of lambda twiddle? Well, it's got to be x mu of lambda, okay, that's how scalars transform, but then I re-express the lambda as a function of lambda twiddle, because lambda twiddle is a function of lambda is a function of lambda twiddle, so I think about that lambda as a function of lambda twiddle, and that is my curve in the new lambda twiddle parameterization. Okay, so it follows that if we calculate the same operator in the lambda twiddle coordinates, okay, so now I've got 1 over root minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda twiddle dx, these are all twiddled, d lambda twiddle. In fact, even the g is twiddled, okay, because g is a scalar as far as the transformation from lambda to lambda twiddle, d by d lambda twiddle. This is equal to 1 over root minus g mu nu d by d lambda d by d lambda x mu d by d lambda. Okay, so to see that's true, just work it out. Okay, so there should be an x mu here. Just work it out. This is x mu twiddle of lambda twiddle. Plug in this formula. It's equal to x mu of lambda twiddle. When you differentiate, you use the chain rule. So this becomes dx mu d lambda d lambda d lambda twiddle. Okay. And now this d lambda twiddle in the numerator will be enough to convert these things into d by d lambdas downstairs. In other words, this factor will cancel these. The d by d lambda twiddle is equal to d lambda twiddle, d by d lambda. Okay, so all those transformation laws will cancel and you get the same formula. So in other words, if this was a solution, then this is, if this was a solution for x, this will be a solution for x twiddle. Okay, so I've kind of labored this, but I hope that clarifies that we have general coordinate invariance both on the spacetime and on the smaller spacetime. Okay, think of the world line as a smaller spacetime. It's a one-dimensional spacetime embedded in a 3 plus 1 spacetime. Okay, so is that clear? Does that help? Okay. I mean, when you come to do string theory, okay, then this whole picture just gets a little bit bigger. Okay, so instead of a world line for a particle, now you will have a world tube, because the string is a closed string is like a closed contour at a given moment of time. But if you watch it going forward through time, then this is a world tube of a string. Okay, and I'm going to have to introduce some coordinates on it. Okay, and then I should insist my theory is invariant under changing coordinates on the world tube or the spacetime or anything else. Okay. And in M theory, you have lines and tubes and membranes and universes of all dimensions embedded within each other. Okay? And everything is invariant under all possible coordinate transformations. Okay? And that's the guiding principle behind the whole theory. Okay. So once you really understand this concept of general coordinate invariance, you actually, that's the key to the whole subject. Okay, so last time we derived the Hamiltonian for a particle, relativistic particle, and I showed you that it was zero according to the equation of motion of the particle implies that Hamiltonian is zero. And that's fine, because that you should think of the Hamiltonian as an operator. And when you quantized, p mu is minus I h bar d by dx mu. Okay. So when you quantize, by the way, this is not a p mu is a spacetime vector. What is not a spacetime vector is p mu acting on a vector. Okay, then you need this covariant derivative. And what we saw is that the Hamiltonian becomes 1 over, well, h bar squared minus 1 over root minus d mu root minus g mu nu h psi is this. Is this psi equals zero? By the way, there's a wonderful review of all this by Bryce DeWitt. And it's Rev Mod Phys in the late 50s. Okay, so Bryce DeWitt was one of the founders of quantum gravity and gauge theory and the whole subject. I think he published 6 papers in his lifetime. Okay. and they're all excellent. Okay. And you might have heard about Kaluza-Klein theory, or the theory of extra dimensions and all that. So that theory, that the whole treatment of that is an exercise in one of his conference proceedings. Which he gave in the 1960s. And nobody noticed it until in the early 80s it became fashionable. But he just gave it as an exercise for the student. So, So he's a very interesting person, and it's really worth looking at this article, because he discusses from first principles how to quantize a particle, what is the meaning of the path integral for a relativistic particle. He discusses in detail this ambiguity. I mentioned yesterday that you can add in this term in curved space-time. And so what he really pointed out is that Feynman's path integral is ambiguous in a curved space-time, and therefore it needs some extra principle to define it. Okay, so we got this. Now, what does this mean? I haven't really discussed what this means, but when we do quantum field theory, so QFT, this equation becomes the field equation for the field, the quantum field, and I'm going to call it phi instead of a wave function. So the modern interpretation of this equation is not that psi is a wave function, but actually psi becomes a quantum field phi, which is an operator, quantum field operator. And so the way we think about this is that the first equation is somehow an intermediate step that describes the quantum mechanics of one particle, which is not entirely consistent, okay? And then what you do is you introduce, you replace phi with an operator phi hat, and that describes the quantum field. So I'm not going to go through the arguments which lead you to do that, because they're really beyond the scope of this course. But all I'm really concerned with is the relativistic invariance and general coordinate invariance of the field equation, and that I've at least motivated. So let's imagine that we've got this quantum field. I'm going to still treat it as classical and ask what is the action for phi. Okay, so here's the field equation for phi. I just write down this equation, but psi is replaced by phi. And now let's ask, what is the corresponding field action? And this will be S phi, the action for phi. And so let's see if you can guess what this is going to be. It's an integral over space-time. I've got to use this invariant volume element. That's the scalar volume element. And then I'm going to put some stuff in here. What could I do? I have the scalar quantity. I have to somehow get a second order differential equation. What terms could I put in this action? So I want two derivatives in my equation of motion. What should I put in there? What should I put here? Not too much you can do. So I've got to have something with two derivatives, right? Because the equation of motion has two derivatives. Pardon? Yeah, exactly. So in fact, we do it this way. D mu phi, d mu phi. OK, so that's obviously a scalar quantity. Because remember, one derivative of a scalar is a covariant vector. And if I contract it with g, this will be a scalar. So that's fine. The minus half is basically for reasons relating to the energy. I want the energy to be positive, and that determines the sign of that term. The half is just a normalization choice. That won't do the whole story. I want to reproduce something with m squared in it. Okay. So I need a term here, and it turns out what I want. You see, this equation is linear in phi, so I need something quadratic in phi squared here. So I just introduce that term. OK, so then the claim is that delta S phi by delta phi equals 0 reproduces this equation that I wrote down, H phi equals 0. OK, so to see that's true, let's just do the variation. So delta S phi is equal to integral d4x root minus g. OK, now I've got to vary this with respect to phi. There are two terms here, so that'll give me a factor of 2 minus g mu nu d mu delta phi d nu phi. And then I vary this guy. Again, I get a factor of 2 phi delta phi. And now I integrate by parts on the delta phi. So this whole term here becomes, so I operate with that derivative on everything else. OK, so this becomes plus d mu, well, plus and then a delta phi outside, and then d mu on everything that multiplied this term, root minus g, g mu nu, d nu phi. OK, and then, of course, let's write it like this, integral d4x. And then here I have minus then I have minus m squared phi. Sorry, that's a square bracket. OK, and that's supposed to be equal to 0 for all delta phi. I've dropped a surface term. You always drop a surface term. You assume the variation 0 on the surface of the region of space-time you're considering. And this is exactly, this is equal to, sorry, there was a root minus g there, wasn't there? Minus root minus g. And so this is equal to root minus g h phi. OK, so I recover exactly h phi equals 0. So that's the action for a scalar field phi. And the natural question now, yeah, go ahead. Oh, yeah, it's a good question. I've set h bar equals to 1 here. I've set h bar equals 1. If you think about dimensional analysis, it should be clear where the h bar comes in. Basically, you know that mass. OK, so I've got a mass in there. That is supposed to be, well, let me see. Yeah, I would struggle to put all the c's back in. I've set h bar and c equals 1. If you'll allow me to set c equals 1, OK, then you know from this formula that momentum is h bar d by dx mu. And that should have the same dimensions as mass. OK? The dimensions of momentum and mass should be the same. So obviously, this thing requires an h bar squared. So that this term has the same dimensions as that. That's all. Now, In fact, you see, when you write this down, you're actually free to rescale the field. I could say phi is phi twiddle over h bar. And that would remove the h bar from there and put it over here. OK, so you're also free to do that. So I could write this as, well, as phi. That's entirely equivalent. So that's, in fact, normally what's done. The convention usually used in quantum field theory is that the kinetic term, this is called a kinetic term, though it involves all the space-time derivatives, this kinetic term is taken to be in this canonical form, just with a factor of a half. Okay, so a natural question to ask is, what's the stress energy for the scalar field? Okay, so T mu nu for the scalar field. So I'm supposed to just vary this with respect to the metric, and I'll get the quantity that comes into the Einstein equations. And so that is 2 over root minus g delta s phi. So T mu nu for the scalar field will be g mu nu. Okay, so I just vary this with respect to the g, find the coefficient of delta g mu nu, and that gives me directly the stress tensor. And so I'll just write out the answer and then justify it. So this is g mu nu times minus a half g mu nu d mu phi d nu phi minus 1 half n squared phi squared plus d mu phi d mu phi. So that's the stress energy in a scalar field. How did I get that? Well, I had to vary this thing again. Remember the formula that delta of root minus g is equal to 1 half root minus g g mu nu delta g mu nu. Did anybody actually work out that formula? I asked you to do it. You did it in the tutorial. No? Contract it with what? No, it's got two upstairs indices. Oh, sorry, this one is not good. That's g alpha beta alpha beta. OK, but the free indices are mu and nu. So of course, what this means is d mu phi is equal to g mu alpha d alpha phi. Right? Derivative is really defined with a downstair index. This is d by dx alpha. Partial derivative with respect to x alpha has a downstairs index. And d mu phi with an upstairs index is just the raised version. So where did that come from? By the way, the derivation of this formula is the following, that, as you know, a determinant is equal to a sum of cofactors times the matrix elements. Sorry, times the, yes, the determinant is equal to a sum of just see if I can express it simply. Actually, not, let me not even try. OK. We can try and do it later if you want. So if I use this formula, then the delta of this will give me precisely the first term here. OK? Because I get 2 over root minus g, that cancels the half root minus g, and I get g mu nu upstairs times delta g mu nu. So the variation of this guy, okay, produced this whole first term. And then the only other place g appears is here, and then I use the variation of the inverse of the metric, which was minus g mu alpha delta g alpha beta g beta nu. And so I get that last term here. Okay, so from that you know the, from that you know everything you need to know to do cosmology with a scalar field, for example. Okay, because you know the metric for cosmology. You now know the stress energy for a scalar field. And so you can just write down the Einstein equations. And that's all you need to know. And we may do that on Friday. Okay, are there any questions? Yeah?
How do you fix the problem that usually you want the stress energy tensor to be symmetric and nice things like that? But sometimes the Mathers theorem doesn't give a symmetric
variant. That's why this definition is better. This definition gives a symmetric stress energy,
but
which is also conserved. This one gives a stress tensor which is symmetric and conserved. It does not give the same answer as the straightforward application of Noether's theorem. So straightforward Noether theorem, for example, for electromagnetism, does not give a symmetric stress tensor. So what you have to do if you use Noether's theorem is you have to fix it up. And the way you fix it up is by adding some quantity whose divergence is identically zero. It doesn't rely on the equations of motion. It's just identically zero. And you're always free to add that to a stress tensor. Right? So say I've got some stress. Say I found some tensor. It's not even symmetric. But let's imagine I found some tensor that satisfies this equation. But it's not symmetric. Okay. Well, if I'm able to add to it some other quantity where whose divergence identically, right, then this combination, if this combination is symmetric, then I'm happy. I found some quantity that is conserved and it's symmetric. But if you apply Noether's theorem, that you have to kind of do by hand. You have to go around looking for some d-mu-nu, which is identically conserved, and add that to the T mu nu in some quantity such that the answer is symmetric. So there's a bit kind of patching up that you have to do.
Doesn't that quite mean that there's something wrong with the theorem itself?
No, it's nothing wrong with the theorem. Because what happens is that it turns out that when you do this, the D mu nu is itself a divergence. Okay, so this will be divergence of some vector. And so that when you compute the contribution of this to the energy or the momentum, that vanishes. So that's what happens in electromagnetism, is you patch up the stress tensor, you added a divergence, but it's when you work out what is its contribution to the energy or the momentum, density, it turns out it's a spatial divergence. And so when I integrate over space, I actually get nothing. So the theorem is correct. It's telling you you've got some quantity that's conserved. It gives you the density of that quantity. But it's just in a kind of ugly form. And it's in a form which is not just ugly, but which you can't couple to gravity. Because you can't put it on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, because it's not symmetric. So you have to kind of patch it up by adding spatial divergences which do not contribute to the energy or the momentum but are identically conserved. Yeah.
Could you just remind me why ds dq is the stress energy tensor?
Oh, because it just follows from the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay. So what we say is that the action is equal to the gravitational action plus the matter action. And the gravitational action was this thing, R over 16 pi g. and then plus S matter. And now I varied this, and what I found was root minus G delta G mu nu, and then I have R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R over 16 pi G. And then, of course, I've got delta S matter delta G mu nu times delta G mu nu. Actually, with the root minus G, so like that. OK, so that's just what you get when you vary with respect to G mu nu. And so this is going to give you an equation of motion that R mu nu minus 1/2 G mu nu R is equal to 8 pi G times 2, because of the 16 pi G there, times the root minus G is here, over root minus G times delta SM delta G mu nu. So this is just the right hand, so that is G mu nu. Okay, so it's kind of it's kind of cute that all you have to do is vary with respect to the metric. And that, by definition, is the stress tensor. And providing your equations of motion are consistent, you are guaranteed that d mu t mu nu is 0. Because the d mu of this is 0, and so it follows the d mu of that must be 0. So it's a very, very cute way of deriving a stress tensor. And as I mentioned, it's even useful even if you're in flat space and you don't care about gravity. This is still the best way to derive the stress tensors. Imagine that you really did go from flat to a slightly curved space and vary your action and get the stress tensor. So for example, if I want the stress tensor for a scalar field in Minkowski space, I just take this formula and put G equals eta. And that's the right answer. And the same for electromagnetism. Okay, it automatically gives me the right result. So if you want it, it's a bit of a painful exercise. But for electromagnetism, the action is equal to integral d4x root minus g times minus 1/4 f mu nu, where that's the field strength tensor. And so you can rewrite that as f mu nu f rho alpha g mu rho g nu alpha. OK, and then the f mu nu, what is f mu nu? So f mu nu, I think we discussed earlier, is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, where this is the vector potential. And so I regard the action as a function of A. So S, so this is for EM. S is a functional of the vector potential and the metric. OK. And if I vary this delta S delta A, I'll get the Maxwell equations. And if I vary delta S with respect to G, I'll get the stress tensor for the Maxwell field. OK, so I think when I wrote down the stress tensor before, it's kind of arbitrary, right? We had F squared with funny indices in funny places minus something times F squared contracted times G. And that's exactly what comes out of here. OK, so I'll just leave you to work that out and check that you get the right stress energy tensor for the Maxwell field. So in particular, you'll get the pointing vector out of this, and you'll get the fact that the energy density in electromagnetism is 1/2 E squared plus 1/2 B squared. Those just follow from this Okay, so now what I want to do is to go on to more in depth into black holes. And so we derived the Schwarzschild metric for a spherically symmetric black hole. And now what we're going to do is to dive into the black hole, okay? And to see what happens as you fall into a black hole. And what really is the space-time in a black hole? I think, as we discussed, when you're outside the black hole, r is radius, and that's a spatial coordinate. When you go inside the black hole, r is really the time. Okay, and so inside the black hole, it's not in the space-time is not static. In fact, some people compare it to a waterfall. Okay. When I cross the event horizon of a black hole, I'm actually in a waterfall. And the waterfall's going one place, okay? And that's the singularity. And there's no way to travel upstream, okay? And so that's the picture we'll now work out in detail. Okay, so this is extending the Schwarzschild. Metric. And we will work out what's called the maximal extension of the Schwarzschild metric, which is basically the complete picture of the space-time inside the black hole, and in fact beyond the black hole, as I'll describe. I should tell you a funny story. When I was a young faculty member and I went to some meeting, I gave a lecture about strings in cosmology and all that, and I was very excited about it. And Chandrasekhar was there. Okay, so Chandrasekhar was sort of the master of relativistic astrophysics, and he's written this massive book, which I defy anyone to read. Okay, with equations that are as long as the pages, and you know, people worked for decades to reproduce his calculations. But anyway, so he came up to me after the talk and he said, "Look, I enjoyed the talk, but you know, why are you working on all this speculative stuff? Why don't you take a theory you know is true, like Einstein's theory of gravity, and just work out what it means, even in situations that are not physically observable?" Okay? Who needs to test it? We don't need to test it. We know it's true. So we can just work out what the possibilities for the world are. And, you know, this is great fun. And that was his philosophy. So he didn't actually care about the real world at all. It was like Alice in the Looking Glass. And when we look inside black holes, it's exactly what we'll discover. There's a world in there which is totally Alice in the Looking Glass. Okay? Alice in Wonderland, I should say. It's totally Alice in Wonderland. And all kinds of strange things happen inside of black holes. So we will find closed time-like curves. You can go back and kill your father or mother if you wish to. You can come out in a completely different universe. You can do all kinds of magical things, okay? But this is in this world which Chandrasekhar believed was real. There are reasons to argue against that, actually, but we'll get to them at a moment. But it's a sort of funny subject where you just go into realms of space-time which are kind of fictitious but reliable in a sense, mathematically reliable. Okay, so we start with the Schwarzschild metric. Okay, so that was ds squared is minus 1 minus rs over r dt squared plus 1 minus rs over r dr squared, that's an inverse, plus r squared d omega squared. And this, you remember, was d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. Um, OK, so we want to study this metric. But the metric goes singular at r equals rs. Remember, the definition of a manifold, a differentiable manifold, was that every point should look locally like Minkowski. And that requires that the metric has one negative and three positive eigenvalues at every point. And if that's true, then I've shown you, you can choose coordinates where it looks locally like Minkowski. What are the eigenvalues of this metric at r equals rs? Okay, metric is a matrix, 4x4 matrix. Well, it's actually diagonal. So what are its eigenvalues at r equals rs? Right, g is just minus 1 minus rs over r plus 1 minus rs over r inverse, r squared, and then r squared sine squared theta. What are the eigenvalues at r equals rs? 0. One of them 0. What's this one? Infinity. OK, so it looks bad. This looks nothing like flat space. One of the eigenvalues is 0, and the other is infinity. And so, you know, this is not a differentiable manifold anymore. Doesn't look like flat space. So that's one problem. The second problem is that, related, of course, is that R is a space-like variable for R bigger than RS. But it's time-like, or coordinate, let's say, coordinate. It's a time-like coordinate for r less than rs. OK, because obviously if r is less than rs, and t is the opposite. T is the opposite. OK, so if r is bigger than rs, this number is positive, and t looks like the time. But if r is smaller than rs, this number is negative, and t looks like space. T is a spatial coordinate, because that's the plus sign. And r is just the opposite. So somehow, these coordinates go from being time to space, okay, at this special radius, r equals rs. So how do we make sense of that? And the answer is to consider radial null rays. Okay, so in other words, I look at this metric, and I try to find how light propagates in this metric. And that will assist me in choosing new coordinates that don't have this problem. Now, radial null rays are extremely easy to solve for. Okay? You don't need to, they satisfy the GDC equation, but you don't even need the equation. The reason is that the proper distance along the a null ray is 0. Ds squared is 0, right? G mu nu, x dot nu is 0. So ds squared is 0. This is 0, because it's not moving in the angular direction. And so therefore, I just set the sum of these terms to 0, and that gives me a differential equation for r as a function of t. OK, so they're trivial to solve. So radial null ray, I just set ds squared equals 0 allows you to solve very simply. OK, so you can, if you like, work out the geodesic equation, but you're just wasting your time. The easy way is just to set ds squared equals 0. And notice that is a first-order differential equation for r as a function of, sorry, actually for t as a function of r, right? So set ds squared to 0, and you have dt squared equals 1 over 1 minus rs over r squared, dr squared, Okay, so take the square root. So dt is plus or minus 1 minus 1 over r is over r dr. That is convenient to rewrite as plus or minus dr. This r in the denominator is a little bit annoying. So let's write it as rs over r minus rs. OK, these two are equal because if I add this term to that one, then I'm going to get in the numerator r minus rs plus rs over r minus rs. The rs's cancel, divide by r, and I'll get just that term. OK, so I can integrate this to get t as a function of r. So t is plus or minus r plus rs log r over rs minus 1. And there's a bracket outside the whole thing. This is valid if r is bigger than rs. You see, the log is happening because something funny is going on at rs. And unsurprisingly, you expect something funny there. And so this calculation is fine for r bigger than rs, but I have to be careful to make the argument of the log positive, right? So when you do this calculation of t, there's an arbitrary integration constant. And you pick it so that the argument of the logarithm is constant. So there's a constant over there. But for r less than rs, this wouldn't make sense, because the argument of the log would be negative, so the log would be imaginary, would have an I pi, right? Log of minus 1 is I pi. And so so you have to pick a constant to make sure the log is real. So this is rs log 1 minus r over rs plus constant for r less than rs. OK, so those are the two null geodesics, which which are radial. OK, so they don't move. So one of them is coming in to towards r equals 0, and the other one's going out. And so if we draw a picture, this is what's going on. Here's t as a function of r. Well, t and r. And then we're going to label this is rs, r equals rs. And let's now sketch the trajectories of these null geodesics. And so out here, both of them are at 45 degrees. I'll do them in green chalk. OK, so out there, it's t is just so at large r. This term is much bigger than the log. Log is always small if r is large. And so at large r, they look like this. OK, and in fact, I'll draw them like that, because each point on the diagram is a two-sphere, right, labeled by theta and phi. So at every point on this t and r, for each value of t and each value of r, I actually have a two-sphere, because I've got the theta and phi as well. So whenever I draw these coordinates, you have to bear in mind there's really a two-sphere sitting at each point. And so when you include those directions, then these null rays are actually, the radial null rays are not unique, right? The radial null rays are specified by two angles on that two-sphere. So we'll draw them like that. So at large radius, those are the two solutions, the plus or minus. And if we follow the ingoing one, it will do this, and it will bend upwards. You see, T is minus R for that guy. And then I've got the log. But the log, when its argument gets T is minus R. Yeah, so the minus sign gives me the T is minus R. But the log, when R gets close to RS, this number is becoming very small. So the log becomes very large and negative. And that times the minus sign gives you a large positive thing, which will diverge as R goes to RS. So that's how the ingoing null rays appear. And if we pick one that's even further ingoing, then what it will do is this. And the outgoing rays will do that. And so the light cone is given by the light cone is given is bounded by those two null rays. Okay, so again, if I look at the plus one at large radius, that is T proportional to R. But as R gets small, this number becomes small, the log becomes negative, and so this will diverge at minus infinity. Okay? So this is what happens, is that these null geodesics never actually cross the RS. They just zoom off to infinity. T equals plus infinity. Okay. Now there's a bunch of null geodesics inside, and they look like the following. They do this. Again, you can see that. I just take this formula inside. T is plus R, but when R gets close to RS, again, this number gets very small. The log gets negative, and that wins. And so be the wrong way around. T is oh yeah, sorry, that's right. T equals plus R. I think there is a minus sign here. There is a minus sign here. Why? Because dt is plus or minus, and then dr. Differentiate this guy, you get an extra minus sign because the minus inside the log, right? So this gives you, that's funny. To me, like there's a minus sign there. Okay, let me sketch it, and we can check the algebra later. This is what it should look like. Okay, so inside RS, you have some null rays which are falling in, and which hit the singularity at r equals 0. And you also have some null rays which come out. But again, they go off to t equals plus infinity. OK, so how are we going to analyze analyze this? Leave that one up. Okay. So I'm just going to use those outer coordinates. And let us define some new coordinates. Okay, so if you find a problem in a metric, the first thing to suspect is the coordinates, that you just use bad coordinates. And they don't, they somehow degenerate at this place. So let's try some new coordinates. And these are called ingoing Eddington Finkelstein. Coordinates. And so Eddington was the person I told you about before. Finkelstein was a theoretical physicist in the 50s who was playing around with these. As I mentioned, there really wasn't any progress from the 20s to the 50s. And this is what Finkelstein came up with, which is to say, let's let U equal to T plus R plus RS log R over RS minus 1. In fact, I'm going to, let me just define it. With a modulus sign. Okay, so U by definition is this constant of integration. There was a constant here. Okay, so we just define U so that it's constant on the ingoing null rays. Equals constant on ingoing null rays. Right? They're ingoing because if U is constant, then T is minus R, minus the log. And so as time goes positive, R gets smaller. OK, so in fact, this curve is actually just U equals constant. All of these curves, this one and this one, are just U equals constant. So the argument is, well, let's get rid of T. Maybe T is a bad coordinate. We see that T diverges as we follow one of these light rays in. We don't want the time to be infinite when the light ray encounters RS. So let's just get rid of T and replace it with U. And so from this, you can calculate du. So that's easy enough to work out. Du is dt plus dr. And then if you differentiate that log, you'll get dr over. So differentiating that log, I'll get the 1 over rs, which cancels. I'll get 1 over r. I'll get 1 over r over rs minus 1. And this is equal to R minus RS times RS on the top. And if I combine these two terms, I'll get dt plus R dr over R minus RS. And so that's equal to dt plus dr over 1 minus RS over R. And so from this, I get that what dt is. So dt is du minus dr over 1 minus rs over r. And now I remember the metric. So that was just minus 1 minus rs over r dt squared plus 1 minus rs over r inverse dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And now I can just substitute in for dt. And so obviously, I get a du squared times this. So I've got the du squared. Then I'm going to get a cross term, right? From the dt squared, I get this terms times that times a factor of 2. The denominator will cancel the numerator there. And the minus signs will cancel. So I'll get plus 2 dr du plus r squared d omega squared. Okay, so that's the metric in the new coordinates. Now, it's a pretty nice metric, because as r goes to rs, this term vanishes. R goes to rs. This term is 0. But I have all of this. And what does that mean? Well, G is a matrix here. in the RU coordinates. The fact I've got the 2 there means they're only off diagonal. So basically GRU is equal to 1 is GUR. So G looks like a matrix, okay, with R squared sine squared theta down here. And what are the eigenvalues of this matrix? What are the eigenvalues of that matrix? 1 and minus 1. Okay, because that's just a Pauli matrix, and I can rotate it. I can rotate it to this matrix, so that doesn't change the eigenvalues. So eigenvalues are 1 and minus 1. So that's great because we have one time and one space coordinate, and no problem. This metric is completely non-singular at R equals RS. So in Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, there is no singularity at RS. Yeah, so this is exactly the question I predicted last week. It's very good. It's a good question. That I have done a coordinate transformation which was singular at R equals RS. Why? Because I wrote down U. U was equal to T plus R plus RS log R of RS minus 1. This thing is singular when R equals RS. It goes to minus infinity as R tends towards RS from above. So this is a singular coordinate transformation. Right? So for example, if I calculate du by dr, this will go to infinity as R tends to RS. So now comes the main point, that the only way to rescue a singularity is to do a singular coordinate transformation. Yeah, absolutely right. So now what you claim is that the original T coordinate, TR coordinates, were just crap coordinates. I should never have worked in those coordinates. They're the problem. Blame the coordinates, okay? I should have worked in R and U. That's a good coordinate system. The metric's fine.
Yeah, but shouldn't I be able to find a coordinate system where I can smoothly get results from T to?
If the metric is singular in one coordinate system, the only way to rescue it is to do a singular coordinate transformation. You see, because a gentle coordinate transformation is not going to affect a singularity. Singularity is a bad, bad, bad thing. The only way to rescue is to do a bad coordinate transformation that cancels the badness of the metric. Yeah?
Do you think this key that started, like, derived all the Einstein equations and stuff?
Absolutely. Exactly. You never even notice this. If I just started in U and R, I would never notice any problem. Anyone can do it. You're guaranteed it'll work because the equations are coordinate invariant. So you just guaranteed that you must have, if you have a solution of the Einstein equations outside RS in the original coordinate system, you are guaranteed that if I do a coordinate transformation outside, it will still be a solution of the Einstein equations. Exactly. The old coordinates T and R were good outside RS. No problem outside RS, and you can change coordinates outside RS. Everything's fine. So the right way to think about this is that you had two coordinate patches. It's exactly the picture we discussed. We have, so here's RS. Here's T and R. And so basically, OK, so the the T and R coordinates were valid for all R bigger than RS. Okay, that was fine. But when you got to RS, they broke down. The U and R coordinates are valid all the way through. Okay, so the U, R coordinates go all the way. Okay, so the U and R are valid for all R bigger than 0. You see, they're still bad at R equals 0, because at R equals 0, there's a singularity. So U and R are just better. They cover more of the manifold than T and R. Things are going to get even more interesting, okay? So now, let me just emphasize that what's really going on here is a process of analytic continuation. That's really what underlies this. So analytic continuation is a bit of a funny thing. You probably did a bit of it with Pedro, right? I've got something which is singular, and I go around it in the complex plane. And at the end of the day, that's what justifies this procedure, okay? That all good coordinates that you can basically analytically continue. So we started out with something in T and R, but actually by going slightly complex, I could avoid these problems, and then I could get inside. So that's one way of looking at this. The other way is to say, just work in some coordinate system where nothing breaks down, okay? And nothing breaks down. And as long as nothing breaks down, then all coordinate system will be equally valid. Okay, so so we've seen that the metric is good in those coordinates, and so let's follow an ingoing null ray. Yeah. No.
It's really singular.
The way to see that this is really a problem, so R equals 0 is a very bad singularity. So this is a real singularity. Where general relativity is just wrong, okay, at R equals 0. And the way you can see that is calculate the Riemann tensor. Okay, calculate the Riemann tensor. It's some complicated function of R. And then square it. Okay, so that is a scalar quantity. That quantity does not depend on coordinate system. You might have thought I could calculate the Ricci scalar. Why would this be a bad idea? It would be 0. You see, we have a solution of the Einstein equations, and so R mu nu is 0 for the Schwarzschild metric. So the Ricci scalar is just 0. So that's not going to show any problem. But the Riemann tensor doesn't have to be 0, because the Einstein equation is not that Riemann is 0, it's that the Ricci tensor is 0. So this is actually not 0, and it's a scalar, okay? Because the indices are contracted, so that's a scalar. So that means that its value is completely independent of coordinate system. So there's nothing I can do to change the value of that quantity. If I change coordinates, that will not change. Yeah. Why is it 0?
Where is it 0?
Everywhere. This solves the Einstein equation. Right? So the vacuum Einstein reads this. This equation implies that the Ricci tensor is 0 and that the Ricci scalar is 0 because you. Yeah. It has 0 Ricci curvature, it has non zero Riemann curvature. So the Ricci scalar is not the only measure of curvature. the Riemann tensor, the components of the Riemann tensor measure the curvature.
It also makes sense that something that you derived using the vacuum assumption would break down at a point where there's just needed a lot of mass, right?
Yeah, you,
which is
it's a good point. When we draw the full space-time diagram, you'll sort of see how it works. But the place it goes singular, when it goes singular, that does not depend on the matter. When we draw the space-time diagram, you'll see that the whole space goes singular in a way that's completely independent of the matter. And it goes singular outside the matter. We'll see that.
But in Bill's talk, you said that as you approach singularity, accelerations get larger, and you get surrounded by a bath of thermal radiation, right? And then in that case, you can't set T to zero, can you?
Yeah, we're just doing classical gravity, not quantum. Okay, so all the effects he's talking about are quantum. There was a hope that quantum effects would remove the singularity, as they do, for example, if you have the electric field of a proton, right, goes like 1 over r squared. So there's a singularity at r equals 0 in the electric field. But when you do quantum electrodynamics, the position of the proton gets fuzzed out by quantum effects. It's not really at one point. And that's enough to remove the singularities, or at least make them renormalizable. It's a delicate point. But basically, you can get rid of the infinities. No such procedure is known in GR. It's a much more violent singularity because all of space-time is becoming singular. We don't know how to get rid of that. So there was a hope quantum effects would smear it out, but nobody really knows how that works.
I was more suggesting that maybe the solution led to set to zero is no longer valid near the singularity at all.
Maybe. But this is just classical gravity, so, yeah.
Sorry, I need to point out that R, what's that supposed to show?
Oh, sorry. So, yeah, I didn't complete the sentence. If I calculate this quantity in the Schwarzschild geometry, it gives me some constant over R to the fourth. The reason is that the Riemann tensor has dimensions 1 over length squared. And so basically it involves, two derivatives of the metric. And when you square it, you get 1 over r. And so that's pretty bad.
So far we don't actually know what really means that r equals 0 point. What does it mean? What does singularity mean?
Means the field equations break down.
You mean it's because you're considering a point particle?
There's no particle. It's a vacuum solution.
Okay. But there's a mass, right? There's a mass in our equations.
There is a mass, but this solution we're describing is the solution of a vacuum equation. So it's a solution
with a lot of mass at the center.
With a lot of mass at the center. But as I said, when we actually look at the structure of the solution, you'll see that it goes singular outside the mass. Okay, it goes singular because basically radius becomes time. And that's true even outside the mass. And so you head to r equals zero kind of inexorably, even outside the mass. And it's singular there. So it's pretty bad. Okay, so let's follow this. We'll see this in more detail again and again. By the way, while we're on the topic, let me just mention that there's a nice theorem, since this came up. There's a theorem that a space-time is flat space. The space-time is flat, meaning, what does that mean? It means that you can pick coordinates in which the metric is just Minkowski. So space-time is just Minkowski space in disguise in another coordinate system, if and only if the Riemann tensor is zero. Okay? So if you've got some metric and you calculate the Riemann tensor and you find it's zero, then you are guaranteed this is flat space in a funny coordinate system, maybe, but it's just flat space. Yeah.
To any order?
Any order. That's a global statement. If the Riemann tensor is zero, you're just looking at flat space in some coordinate system. It's a powerful theorem. It's proved in Stephen Weinberg's book.
OK, but we definitely don't have a zero Riemann tensor, so it's certainly not flat space. Now let's follow an ingoing null ray to see what happens. And so that's just u equals 0. Well, an example of an ingoing null ray is the one on u equals 0, one for which u equals 0. So again, let me graph t against r. And u equals 0 is one particular ingoing null ray. So here's my RS. And so this ingoing null ray with u equals 0 will look something like this. All right, the t goes to infinity as you head towards RS. But now we know I'll write up again my definition of u. U is t plus r plus log mod r over rs minus 1. Now, if I work this out for r less than rs, then the trajectory is one of those curves I drew before, and it turns out it's this one. Okay, you can see that because if I work this out for r less than rs, then again, when r is nearly equal to rs, this is a very small number, so I've got a, I think I want that minus sign. Sorry, no, u is 0. So I was right. There's a plus sign there. U is 0 means t is minus r minus the log. If the log is minus infinity, then t is near plus infinity. And so this is the ingoing null ray. And so you can see that the direction of r, i.e., time, the radial variable is time. This quantity r is the time for r less than rs, is decreasing. OK, so if I think about this in the tr coordinates, the trajectory comes in and then heads to r equals 0 in the following way. So t was singular, but r is OK. So this suggests that there is another region of the space-time inside r equals rs. But in that region, r is a time-like variable. And it carries you towards r equals 0. So we can do this in some detail. By doing the following. So this was the definition of u. So let me define some new time variable t prime. Let's set u equal to t prime plus r. Okay, to make the metric a little bit more like Minkowski space. And so at large r, this is irrelevant. And so t is t prime at large r. At small r, they're going to be pretty different. And so now I will get ds squared equal to, well, I had this formula, 1 minus rs over r du squared plus 2 du dr plus r squared d omega squared. So just plug this formula in. And what you'll get is minus 1 minus rs over r dt prime squared minus 1 minus rs over r dr squared minus 2 1 minus rs over r dr dt prime. OK, so I'm just substituting for du there. And then I've got to substitute in here in this 2 du dr term, so 2 dt prime plus dr dr plus r squared d omega squared. So this is equal to minus 1 minus rs over r dt prime squared plus 1 plus rs over r dr squared plus 2 rs over r dr dt prime plus r squared d omega squared. OK, so these in these Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, where I've defined a new time t prime, again, nothing funny happens at t equals t prime, at r equals rs. This term vanishes, but this term is off diagonal. And the eigenvalues are still 1 and minus 1, so that's fine. The null rays are du equals 0. That's the ingoing null rays, which is dt prime is minus dr. That's ingoing. And then the outgoing ones are dt prime equal to r minus rs over r plus rs dr. These are outgoing. OK, so to get that formula, the second formula, dr, I just set this line element to 0. I set d omega squared to 0. And I have to solve a quadratic equation for dr and dt. There are two solutions. That's one solution. And this is the second solution. So that gives you the ingoing and the outgoing null rays in these new, in this new time coordinate, t prime and r. And so now we can draw this picture, t prime, r. And so lines of constant u is just a t prime plus r. And so lines of constant u look like this. So this is u. And each one of these curves is u equals constant. And an ingoing null ray is always just on u equals constant. OK, so an ingoing null ray is just following this line in these coordinates. The outgoing ones, you can see that if r is bigger than rs, then dt prime is a positive number times dr. And so that's telling you, let's draw our rs here. That's telling you that the slope of the curve is positive if r is bigger than rs. So out here, they're doing this. And as you approach rs, you see the slope dt prime dr, this is the slope of t prime versus r. And so the slope is actually going to 0. The slope dt prime dr. Oh, I wonder if I have a, sorry, I've got a minus sign wrong. It's r plus rs over r minus rs. the slope is going to infinity as you approach RS. And so basically these, so the light cone here is at 45 degrees, but then it is tipping. Okay, the light cone is tipping. And if I draw a curve, an outgoing null ray even closer to RS, then basically this light cone is tipping towards the interior of the black hole. And when I get inside RS, then the null ray is tipped right over so that the future pointing light cone is actually pointing right at the singularity. There's no way to avoid the singularity because I can't escape from the light cone. The future light cone. Okay, so if I was going at the speed of light away from the singularity, I would be on this side of the light cone. That's all I can do. That's the best I can do. Okay, so those coordinates are basically the best coordinates to understand gravitational collapse. And so let's imagine we had some star. This is RS. If you have some star, then essentially what it does in these coordinates is it does something like this. This is the star. Okay, so a star will gradually contract if it doesn't have enough pressure to resist gravity. The star gradually contracts, the radius decreases. At some point, it crosses its Schwarzschild radius. The surface of the star, the world line of a molecule on the surface of the star, has to be within the light cone. It's a time-like particle, right, a massive particle. Has to be inside that light cone. So once the star has crossed the horizon, all the particles that sit on its surface have to move. They've got no option but to move inside this light cone. And therefore, they're all going to hit the singularity. Okay. So here's the star. But as I say, outside the mass that made the star, the space-time is still going singular. It's nothing to do with the matter. And again, we'll see this in the crustal coordinates even more clearly. Okay, that this singularity here is purely a gravitational effect. And the matter's not going to help us get rid of it. Okay, so that's the picture of gravitational collapse in Eddington-Finkelstein ingoing coordinates. There's nothing funny at R equals RS. It's just that you get forced to move to the singularity inside R equals RS. Yeah?
What if we had something that's not exactly spherical symmetry? So are you going to find one singularity inside there?
It's a very good question. And so the history of this is that in the early 60s, people were attacking these problems. And there were some Russians, Lifshitz and Kolatnikov, who studied singularities. And their great hope was that non-spherical symmetry would cure the problem. So what they hoped is the matter would fall in, and it wouldn't go down to a point. It would somehow miss itself. It had some angular momentum, spin around for a while, and then come back out. And so they were hoping there would be some kind of bounce, and you would actually avoid the singularity, that the spherical symmetry was a, you know, degenerate case that would never be physically realized. So then Roger Penrose came along, okay? And Roger Penrose said, no, the critical point here is that you've formed a trapped surface. A trapped surface is a spherical shell of light, okay, that is forced to contract. When the gravitational field becomes sufficiently strong, the spherical shell starts contracting. So normally when I send out light, you know, the shell will expand. But if I've got a trapped surface, then a spherical shell of light will actually shrink. And that was his sort of key concept. He said the critical moment here is when the star has entered its Schwarzschild radius at this point, and now light, which is emitted by the star, is actually trapped. There's no escape for the light. So the formation of the singularity is inevitable once you've crossed that point. And so then what Penrose proved is a mathematical theorem that once you form a trapped surface, you are inevitably going to make a singularity. And that's completely independent of spherical symmetry or anything else. So, what? Is not predicted. His theorem doesn't predict where it is. Doesn't predict anything about the singularity. No, it doesn't predict that. It just says
that the space-time will go singular. If you form a trapped surface, it's going to go singular. He won't tell you what happens to the Riemann tensor or anything. It's a topological statement. It's extremely powerful and general theorem. So Penrose really revolutionized this subject. That was in, I don't know, 64, 66, by showing that the way to tackle these problems was not just by grinding through lots of tensor calculus calculations. It was by putting this all onto a different mathematical footing where the causal structure becomes the key. And then, of course, Hawking generalized Penrose's results to say the same thing about the universe. That given certain assumptions about the universe today, it is inevitable there was a singularity. That was the Big Bang. Big Bang singularity. So, you know, these singularities are very real. I mean, we can see the singularity. We live in a universe that came out of a singularity. Okay. This is what determined everything around us. So, that's Hawking's singularity theorem. Okay. Good. Very good question. Now, time is running on. And I still have a little more to do, so I will just let you vote if you want to continue or you want to start to wait till tomorrow. What? Okay, all those in favor of continuing? Do some half votes. Okay, I think we'll continue tomorrow. Okay.
So, did you sort of start to stalk off?